From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!, broadcasting from Washington, D.C.
Do you have an opinion on whether waterboarding, which is the practice of putting somebody in a reclining position, strapping them down, putting cloth over their faces, and pouring water over the cloth to simulate the feeling of drowning, is that constitutional?
If it amounts to torture, it is not constitutional.
I'm very disappointed in that answer. I think it is purely semantic.
Growing opposition to Attorney General nominee Michael Mukasey after he refuses again to declare waterboarding torture. But first, opponents of media consolidation pack an FCC hearing to criticize plans to rewrite the nation's media ownership rules.
The media owners supported the war and dumbed down. As we caught on to the war issue late, because the information came late. That's why this meeting has global ramifications for justice at home and peace abroad.
And a Senate committee votes today on climate change legislation that would create a carbon trading system in the United States. We'll host a debate. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Bush administration has admitted to sharing key military intelligence with Turkey that could be used for a full-scale assault on Kurdish rebels in northern Iraq. Turkey's deployed an estimated 100,000 troops on its Iraq border in what it calls an attempt to stop Kurdish rebel attacks. On Wednesday, the Pentagon said it's assisted Turkey with spy planes and information on Kurdish positions. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice heads to the region tomorrow. On Wednesday, State Department spokesperson Sean McCormick denied U.S. backing of a Turkish attack.
Talking about Turkey's needs in terms of defending itself, obviously those are decisions that Turkey is going to have to make for itself. But our view remains the same, and I'm sure that she'll have some good discussions with Turkish interlocutors.
The Washington Post is reporting the State Department's facing an internal uproar over new rules that would force U.S. officials to serve in Iraq. The dissent was heard Thursday at a town hall meeting of hundreds of U.S. diplomats in Washington. One Foreign Service officer received sustained applause after calling service in Iraq, quote, a political death sentence that otherwise would have been closed were it anywhere else in the world. Another officer complained the State Department refused to pay for her medical treatment after she returned from Iraq with post-traumatic stress disorder. Diplomats were informed last week nearly 50 vacant positions would be filled in Iraq through mandatory assignments. It's believed to be the first time officials have been ordered into foreign posts since the 1960s. A top U.S. advisor on terrorism has publicly denounced the interrogation technique of waterboarding as a form of torture. On Wednesday, Malcolm Nance said he had witnessed hundreds of waterboarding exercises while working at the U.S. Departments of Homeland Security, Special Operations, and Intelligence. Nance says the practice is taught at a U.S. Navy training facility in San Diego. Waterboarding simulates the experience of drowning by strapping a victim to a board and forcing water into their lungs through a cloth covering the face. Attorney General nominee Michael Mukasey is facing a potential rejection from the Democrat-controlled Senate over his waterboarding stance. Mukasey said this week he does not know if waterboarding amounts to torture. Legal experts interviewed by the New York Times say Mukasey's evasive response could be a deliberate attempt to avoid laying ground for prosecutions against U.S. officials who've practiced waterboarding. Mukasey's nomination goes before the Senate next week. The senior Bush administration official tasked with promoting U.S. foreign policy worldwide has resigned. On Wednesday, Undersecretary for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs Karen Hughes announced she's stepping down later this year. Hughes oversaw a series of marketing campaigns aimed at foreign countries. A recent 47-nation poll from Pew Global Attitudes found the U.S. image in Muslim countries in Asia and the Middle East is, quote, abysmal. Over the past 5 years, favorable ratings of Americans declined in 23 of 33 countries surveyed. The U.S. government has dropped a major deportation case dating back to the Reagan years. On Tuesday, the Board of Immigration Appeals announced prosecutions will end of a 20-year attempt to deport two Palestinian Americans for allegedly raising money for the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. In 1987, the Reagan administration attempted to bar the two men, Khadr Hamid and Michel Shehadi, and six others on the grounds they were connected to a communist group. The men became known as the LA 8. They were never deported because a federal appeals court declared the anti-communist law unconstitutional. Earlier this year, an immigration judge ruled government violated the defendant's constitutional rights in a case he called an embarrassment to the rule of law. The ruling marked the government's sixth unsuccessful attempt at prosecution. Under a settlement, Hamid and Shehadi will be allowed to apply for U.S. citizenship in 3 years. In Burma, hundreds of monks marched in the temple town of Pakokku Wednesday in their first protest since the military junta's crackdown on a mass uprising last month. Witnesses say the monks chanted prayers but refrained from political statements. The march comes ahead of a return visit from UN envoy Ibrahim Gambari. Speaking in Thailand, the exiled Burmese opposition leader Maung Maung called for increased international pressure on the military junta.
We have to stop the money going to the regime, and that is why we're also calling for the Jade Bill, and also we're calling for that the action be taken on oil and energy companies that are working in Burma, so that the money that goes to the regime is blocked, and the regime doesn't have the money that will enable the military to move on to the democratic opposition. That is what we're asking for.
The U.S. oil giant Chevron is among several international firms with close ties to the junta. Meanwhile, Human Rights Watch is accusing the Burmese junta of filling its depleted armed forces with an increasing number of child soldiers. Human Rights Watch Burma consultant David Scott Matheson says children as young as 10 years old are being forced to enlist.
But the dramatic expansion of the military, which has more than doubled the military after 1988, has meant that recruitment has become more predatory and the standards have dramatically dropped. And the morale of the soldiers, as a result, has plummeted as well. And they need all these new soldiers to staff and the battalions and also use all this new equipment that they're buying internationally.
At least 3,500 soldiers are said to be deserting the Burmese army every 3 months. In Spain, 21 people have been found guilty of involvement in the 2004 train bombings that killed 191 people in Madrid. Seven of the accused were acquitted of any role in the bombings, including one alleged mastermind. Juan Carlos Vive Segura of the Terrorism Victims Association said he's disappointed with the verdict.
We were convinced that there were more people behind the attacks, not as part of a conspiracy theory, simply that not only those who sat there were responsible. As a matter of fact, there was only four or five guilty sentences, and only for assisting, not for carrying out these attacks.
The 21 guilty defendants are expected to appeal their convictions. Back in the United States, a jury's ordered a homophobic Kansas church to pay millions of dollars in damages for cheering the funeral of a U.S. Marine because they thought he was gay. On Wednesday, jurors ruled that Topeka's Westboro Baptist Church owes the family of Marine Lance Corporal Matthew Snyder $10.9 million for emotional distress. Church members attended Snyder's 2006 funeral with signs reading, "You're going to hell. And God hates you." Snyder's father, Albert Snyder, welcomed the verdict.
Kind of speechless, I guess, about it. You know, I think, I hope it's enough to deter them from doing this to other families. I mean, that was the goal the whole time. It wasn't about the money. It was about getting them to stop.
Church members say they plan to appeal. In the Caribbean, more than 80 people have been killed in flooding from the tropical storm Noel. At least 56 have died in the Dominican Republic, and some 25,000 have been left homeless. The death toll has hit 24 in neighboring Haiti. An unidentified flooding victim in Port-au-Prince described her ordeal.
For 3 days, we have been without food or clothes. I called the UN troops to see if I could get inside the shelter to see my two children, and they would not let me in.
Haiti is especially vulnerable to flooding because most of its trees have been cut down to make charcoal. Hurricane Noel passed through Cuba last night with no reported casualties. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting from the nation's capital, from Washington, D.C. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to carbon trading, the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee will vote today on climate change legislation written by Senators Joseph Lieberman and John Warner. The bill is called America's Climate Security Act. It aims to combat global warming by using a cap-and-trade system popularly known as carbon trading. This involves setting greenhouse gas emissions limits and allowances for each industry, and then creating a system to trade the allowances. Under the Kyoto Protocol, countries can trade emissions credits, and companies can earn credits by paying for emissions-reducing and clean energy projects in developing countries. Despite the U.S. government's opposition to the Kyoto Protocol, California, New York, and New Jersey embraced carbon trading Tuesday as they joined European governments, Canadian provinces, and New Zealand to launch a forum known as the International Carbon Action Partnership. Nobel Peace Prize winner Al Gore and institutions like the World Bank and the Pew Center on Global Climate Change also support carbon trading as a viable market-based solution to fight global warming. But critics argue carbon trading actually delays the crucial process of big polluters reducing their emissions. Rising Tide North America is one organization that opposes carbon trading. Activists from the group disrupted a Carbon Markets Insights conference held in New York Monday. Posing as delegates, they took to the stage and denounced carbon trading as, quote, a sham approach to the fossil fuel crisis. This is a clip of their presentation at the conference.
We have a very special gift for all of you here as the cutting edge of market-based solutions to climate change. We present to you a deed to the next frontier that is literally over all of your heads.
So, this indenture made on the 30th day of October in the year of our Lord, 2007, on behalf of the Secretary of the Sky, bestows the full and rightful ownership of all parts of the atmosphere to the carbon traders of Carbon Market Insights. Generations of the future
are begging you now.
Renounce this treachery.
So stick this idea, offset your illusion.
There's no market-based fix for unchecked pollution.
Protesters, or as they call themselves, greenwash guerrillas from Rising Tide North America, led away after intervening at the Carbon Trading Expo in New York. Well, today we host a debate on carbon trading. Joining me here in Washington, D.C., two environmentalists, both committed to fighting global warming. Annie Petsunk is International Counsel with Environmental Defense, a leading national environmental advocacy group. She's participated in the development of climate policy since the inception of the climate treaty talks and works to develop international laws that provide economic incentives for environmental protection. Annie Petsunk supports carbon trading. Daphne Wisham is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. She is also the founder and co-director of the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network and a member of the Durban Group for Climate Justice. Her research drew attention to the disproportionate ratio of fossil fuel investments by international financial institutions like the World Bank. Daphne Wisham, opposed to carbon trading. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Annie, why don't you start off by saying why you support carbon trading and explain it in the process?
The global warming problem is an urgent one, and we don't have time to continue putting global warming pollution into the atmosphere. If we want to get countries, companies, and local communities to look for and implement effective opportunities to cut greenhouse gas emissions wherever they can find them, in the home, in the office, in the school, we've got to give people economic incentives so that it becomes in their financial self-interest to cut global warming pollution now. That's what carbon trading does. Implemented effectively, it can be a huge help, along with other policies, in getting our nation to step up to the plate, take some leadership, and tackle this
problem. But explain exactly how it works.
Sure. In cap and trade, every polluter is given a mandatory limit on their greenhouse gas emissions. You get a certain amount of pollution, that's all you're allowed to emit. Essentially, the government opens a bank account for you and puts a certain amount of allowances to emit pollution in your bank account. If you can find a way to reduce your pollution below your allowable level, you have some extra pollution allowances that you can save for the future or to sell to someone else. If someone comes to you and says, hey, I've got a great idea for how you can cut emissions, you can implement that idea, save emissions, and then essentially have a valuable commodity that will be increasing in value in the future, since we have to cut a lot more pollution in the future in order to prevent global warming from really becoming dangerous. And that gives you an economic incentive to look wherever you can to find better, cheaper, faster ways of cutting global warming pollution. So you need two things: a mandatory cap on emissions put there by government, and an incentive program that allows anybody to come up with better, cheaper, faster ways to cut pollution and make money.
Daphne Wisham, what's your problem with it?
Well, you know, this is a nice abstraction, but what we should be looking at is how carbon trading is playing out in reality. If you look at the EU emissions trading system that was up and running, has been up and running for several years, we see that emissions are actually up for greenhouse gas emissions, as are profits. Profits are up for the nuclear industry, for the coal industry, and the average consumer is paying more. Now, the EU emissions trading system, they've begun to make changes in that system. However, essentially what carbon trading does is it turns the Earth's carbon cycling capacity into property that is to be bought and sold in a global market. And by turning carbon into a commodity, we're essentially taking the Earth's ability to support a climate conducive to life and human societies and passing it into the same corporate hands that are destroying the climate. So, you know, one of the problems with the parameters of the climate debate is that for too long, NGOs have been sort of promoting solutions that have been operating in a vacuum of you know, analysis of other issues. Fundamental issues around who profits, who pays, democracy, power, all of these sorts of things are rarely debated. And as a result, we have a very narrow sort of political space in which we're now discussing how we move forward on the issue of climate change.
But explain exactly how it works. I mean, ExxonMobil is given a certain amount of carbon credits, allowed to emit a certain amount of greenhouse gases. And if they want to do more, who do they trade with?
Well, they can trade. It hasn't taken place yet domestically because we don't. I mean, what we have is basically where the U.S. is not signatory to the Kyoto Protocol. But ExxonMobil can trade with itself if it has operations in a developing country eventually. For example, Chevron is now pushing for gas flare reduction projects in the Niger Delta to count as carbon credits under the CDM. Now, this is a process that's illegal. It's been illegal in Nigeria.
You mean the gas flare?
The gas flaring, yeah. And the international community and other institutions have been putting pressure on Nigeria to stop this gas flaring. However, if this carbon credit moves forward as planned, Chevron and the World Bank and some other major international corporations will actually profit from reducing gas flares, essentially getting a profit for doing what is what should be illegal.
Annie Petzenk.
We've had great experience with cap and trade for controlling air pollution in this country since 1990, when Congress passed the Clean Air Act amendments. We put a cap on acid rain pollution and adopted this kind of system to cut acid rain pollution from coal-fired power plants. So in that program, we essentially put the training wheels on the bicycle and learned how to ride the bicycle. That program has cut acid rain pollution far faster than industry and many environmentalists predicted could be done. And it's done so at a fraction of the cost that people projected. Setting up a carbon trading system for the world and for the United States is more complicated. There are more polluters. I agree with Daphne that companies should not be allowed to get credit in a developing country which has no caps on emissions for doing what they were supposed to do anyway. That'd be like me saying to you, Amy, I was planning to eat some cheesecake next week. But I'm not going to eat as much cheesecake as I was actually planning to do. I was going to break my diet and eat a little extra. And I'll sell you my extra cheesecake credits. You would then ask me, oh, Annie, how much cheesecake were you actually planning to eat next week? And of course, I'll tell you I was planning to eat at breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and sell you my extra cheesecake credits for what I don't actually eat. We don't like that system. We don't think it's a workable system. And one of the reasons why we're looking forward to the markup in the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee today is that the bill now being considered there doesn't create that system. It's better than that.
I tend to disagree with that perception, as do quite a few number of groups. Friends of the Earth has recently produced an analysis on the windfall profits in the Lieberman-Warner global warming bill. And according to their calculations, 38% of the giveaways, the free giveaways in this bill, would benefit the fossil fuel industry over the lifetime of the program. That's and roughly $268 billion of that would go directly to the coal industry alone.
Explain what giveaways are.
Well, you know, one of the failures of the EU emissions trading system is that they essentially, the governments essentially gave the right to pollute to certain industries. They set the cap high, and as a result, industry was able to emit as much as they had been emitting in the past and make a profit buying and selling these emissions rights. Similarly, in this, there was no auctioning. Now, in the current Lieberman-Warner bill, there is some auctioning, but about 50% of all of the permits are just being given away for free. Now, these permits are valuable. They are basically being turned into a commodity. So now what we have is essentially the most carbon-intensive of the fossil fuels, the coal industry, is one of the largest beneficiaries of the Lieberman-Warner bill. And an additional $522 billion will potentially go to what they call zero and low-carbon energy technologies. Now, if we are optimistic, we would say, wonderful, that's going to go to renewables. However, the legislation is vague. It could go to either the fossil fuel industry for carbon capture and storage, which is a very expensive and unproven technology, or it could go to the nuclear industry. And that is not specifically ruled out in this legislation. So we have problems with this also because it essentially is a tax on the working poor. It's not a tax on the very corporations that are causing
the
problem.
How is it a tax on the working poor?
Well, because we will see the windfall gains, instead of having those go to, say, subsidize an increase in the price of power, or to public transportation, or to other incredibly important solutions to the climate problem, we will see billions and billions of dollars worth of profits going back to the very industries that are causing the problem.
Annie Petsunk. We believe that the America's Climate Security Act that's going to be voted on this morning in the Environment and Public Works Committee is a very good first step. Is it perfect? No. Are senators moving to improve it? Yes. Senator Lautenberg announced yesterday he wants to broaden the coverage of the bill so that more parts of the economy come under that cap on fossil fuel emissions. We think that's a good thing. He's also proposing to put into the bill a provision that says, let's look at how much global warming we're seeing. You know, the governors of the Southeast states are meeting today here in Washington to try to figure out what to do about their dwindling water resources in the face of the worst drought the Southeast has ever seen. We've got to act now. They recognize that.
Atlanta could run out of water.
Atlanta could run out of water. So what Senator Lautenberg has proposed to do is to put a provision in the bill that requires Congress to keep looking back at the science and see if those caps on pollution need to be tightened. It will tighten them. The bill does start out for about half of the polluters who are covered by making them purchase allowances, not get them for free. And over time, it increases the amount they have to purchase, and it reduces the amount that the government gives them for free. That's a sensible approach. Could it be faster? Yes. but it gets us started, and that's the most important thing because we don't have time to wait.
Can I just, I think it's important to take some specific examples. I think it's instructive to look at, for example, the World Bank, which I have been monitoring for over 10 years now. Now, they have invested over 15 times as much in fossil fuels as renewables since 1992. Originally, it was 100 to 1. Now they are getting into the carbon trading market. The U.S. Treasury, back in 1997, said this is a clear conflict of interest for a financial institution to both profit from financing fossil fuels and profit from carbon trading. They're actually charging somewhere on the order of 13% commission on all carbon trading transactions. Now, what the World Bank could have done and should have done instead of getting into the carbon trading market is they should have set a higher energy efficiency standard. They should have stopped subsidizing fossil fuels. They should at the very least be calculating their climate footprint, which they are not doing. So they're calculating the carbon credits, but they're not calculating the carbon debits. Now, if you globalize that particular model and look at how that would play out with bank after bank, whether it's Citibank or the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development or other public or private banks, you see how these banks are going to be gaming the system. They will be profiting from selling, giving loans to the likes of Chevron, and then they'll be profiting again from charging a commission on the CO2 that is captured from those operations in developing countries or potentially in the U.S. So, you know, what I think people need to understand is, yes, the time is urgent. We need to take action very soon on this issue. However, we need to learn the lessons from the failures of the EU emissions trading system. And the bill that's on the Senate floor this morning is not the best way to move forward. It's a corporate giveaway, and we need to do better. Boxer needs to hear from people on this.
Last word, Annie Petsunk, on this. Is this just a corporate gift, a subsidy, a giveaway?
If America doesn't take the lead beginning to tackle our global warming pollution, other nations won't either. I strongly support getting rid of fossil fuel subsidies for big coal-fired power plants in China and India and in the U.S. We've got to start. We cannot afford to delay. This bill is not a corporate subsidy or a giveaway. It's a first step in getting America on a track to a cleaner energy future and a safer climate.
15 seconds, Daphne Wishin, then what's your alternative since you are so critical of
this?
Well,
I think, you know, what we have is a political opportunity here. We know that the president is going to veto any kind of legislation that comes from the Senate. He has made clear his opposition to any
even
kind of
Lieberman and Warner?
Even Lieberman and Warner. So why aren't the Democrats, why are they kowtowing to Bush? Why aren't they pushing forward the most aggressive piece of legislation that they can get as a benchmark and say, this is what we're going to be pushing for in the next administration? And, you know, we can do better. We should be debating these issues. We should be setting much more stringent targets, at least 80% below 1990 levels by 2050. This bill gets us nowhere near that. And so that's my concerns with it.
Daphne Wishin and Annie Petsunk, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Annie Petsunk of Environmental Defense. Daphne Wishin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, we'll be joined by FCC Commissioners Adelstein and Copps. Stay with us.
I love the warmth of the sun on my nose, and the sun shine on my clothes, and I'm loving the warmth of the wind. I love the rush of the wind in my hair as I dancing in air, and I'm loving the rush of the sand. I love the crunch of the sand in my toes, and the sand dunes marching in rows. Oh, I'm loving the crunch of the sea.
I love the dance of the sea, swimming so fearless and free, floating and diving. I'm loving the
stars, I love the glow of the stars.
stars, flying so high into space. This is my place, and I'm loving the glow of the rain in my face. I love the way of the rain, my face, my nose, my hair, 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 my
I love the warmth of the sun, sun, sun on my nose, and the sun, sun, shine on my clothes, and I'm loving the warmth of the wind, wind.
Nature Song, Sweet Honey in the Rock, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Opponents of media consolidation packed a hearing room at the Federal Communications Commission Wednesday to criticize plans to rewrite the nation's media ownership rules. FCC Chair Kevin Martin has proposed to do away with a rule that bars companies from owning both a newspaper and a television or radio station in the same city. In 2003, Martin voted with the then FCC chair, Michael Powell, to lift the same media ownership rules. But the effort was overturned by the landmark Prometheus versus FCC decision. The FCC was ordered to justify the changes and their impact on diversity and localism. The Reverend Jesse Jackson, radio broadcaster Bob Edwards, and others testified at Wednesday's hearing. Edwards warned that if the FCC relaxes its rules, radio station owners would, quote, adopt a business model that shuts out local news and entertainment in favor of national homogenized programming. Before the hearing started, the Reverend Jesse Jackson briefly addressed a rally outside the FCC.
When we're discussing the networks, where are the networks? As when we're discussing the networks, we are the networks. By denying us access to the networks, they make our case. Then by locking us out, people cannot respond because people do not know. I must say before the next speaker, as I traveled around the world just before the Iraq War, 2 million people marched in Britain. 1 million plus marched in France. Almost 500,000 in Australia. Why would those so few people march in America? Because the media owners supported the war and dumbed down. And we caught on to the war issue late because the information came late. That's why this meeting has global ramifications for justice at home and peace abroad. So let's keep marching. Yeah.
The Reverend Jesse Jackson, president of Rainbow Push Coalition. We're joined right now in Washington by two of the FCC commissioners, Michael Copps and Jonathan Adelstein. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Michael Copps and Jonathan Adelstein are the two dissident commissioners. We also invited Kevin Martin on the broadcast. He declined our invitation. Jonathan Adelstein, let's begin with you. Why exactly was this hearing held? How much advance notice did people get for this hearing? And what's being weighed?
People weren't really given notice of this meeting until the last possible moment allowed by law, just 5 business days before it met. So we had a fairly small turnout, a very powerful turnout, though, of people that gave witness to the fact that localism, coverage of local issues, is diminished as media giants get larger and larger, as they consolidate. They don't cover what's happening in local communities. They don't live in the local community. They don't serve local communities as well. So that was the message of this hearing. It's about localism. We had a proceeding that Michael Powell started discussing how can media outlets be more responsive. And it was basically put on ice by the current chairman, but the members of Congress demanded that it be finished before we move to media consolidation. So yesterday, just to sort of check the box, we held this hearing. And it turned out, of course, again, an outpouring from the American people, from experts, that localism is not well served by media consolidation.
What is localism?
Localism is whether or not a broadcast outlet is responsive to the issues in the community. For example, there's very few minority or women owners of broadcast outlets. Their issues aren't handled in ways that those communities consider to be sensitive or responsive to their many contributions to the community at large.
Michael Copps, what is new about what Kevin Martin is doing? What exactly is he saying he wants to do?
Nobody knows. That's one of the problems that we have here. He's trying to get us on a fast pace, do a fast break for more media consolidation. Probably would include some loosening of the ban or elimination of the ban on newspaper broadcast cross-ownership. And one of the really bombshell things that came out of the meeting yesterday was research that was presented by Free Press that just knocks the traces out from under the Martin argument and the previous FCC argument that newspaper broadcast ownership isn't so bad after all. It shows this research conclusively that if you combine newspapers and broadcasts in a market, any size market, that the coverage of local news in that market is going to be diminished. You know, the one broadcaster that's combining with a newspaper might be able to put on a little bit more news, but it's going to drive others out of the market. It's going to close more newsrooms, and it's going to detract from voices in that particular market. So I think that just that one argument alone ought to put this on hold. Isn't it amazing that we're always talking about eliminating rules, rather than saying we live in a new media market now, the new world of DTV, the new world of Rupert Murdoch, the new world of private equity financing. Do we need some new protections for the American people? How has this changed things? It's always fast break for big media, four-corner stall for the public interest.
Who specifically benefits most by this? What media owner in the country?
Oh, I think any of the big consolidated companies, we all know who they are, the big folks, they're the ones that are pressing. But, you know, I think it goes beyond that, because if we really loosen the rules and some medium-sized broadcaster here can trade this station for so we can have a duopoly in another market, you know, a lot of them would supposedly benefit from that.
You have Sam Zell, who just bought the Tribune Company. The Tribune Company had grandfathered in that they could have radio and television, newspaper in a town. But once a new owner buys, like Zell, he will lose that unless these restrictions are relaxed, the ones that Kevin Martin has suggested doing. Jonathan Adelstein.
Well, another option that Zell has asked for is a waiver of the rules until we finalize the broader media ownership rules. But Kevin Martin has basically held the whole Tribune deal hostage to the broader issue. In other words, he's trying to shoehorn changing the broader rules for the whole country in order to get Tribune done. He's saying, I'm going to basically not do Tribune until you do everything, until you let everybody combine newspapers and broadcast.
Why should Tribune get this waiver?
Well, it's not clear whether they should or shouldn't, but what is clear is that you shouldn't be holding one transaction hostage to the broader issue. I think that there's some support on both sides of the aisle for this Tribune deal, depending on where members are from, so he's trying to use that as a wedge, essentially. And I don't think it's right to take a transaction hostage. No matter what you think of the transaction, up or down, whether the waiver should be approved, it's just not right to say that we're going to make all these folks wait while we try to force through these changes that'll affect the entire media market for the United States.
At the same time that this hearing was happening, Michael Copps used the opportunity to say that Rupert Murdoch's buying of the Wall Street Journal should be investigated by the FCC. Why?
Absolutely. This is a huge, huge media deal, a huge transaction. It implicates not only all of the national properties that News Corp would own, but it has direct effects in the New York City market. Now, some of the FCC have been arguing that we have no jurisdiction over this deal because this is a national newspaper rather than a local newspaper, and we're only supposed to be looking at local newspapers. And there's some murky precedent back when USA Today was adjudged to be a national newspaper years and years ago in a totally dissimilar media market. I think our public interest responsibilities in this new media age clearly mandate that we look at the ramifications of this both from a national perspective, but also from the local perspective. It is there. If you control the New York Post and the Wall Street Journal and all of these other properties, you are a big player in determining the cultural and political voice and the messages that get to that city. and that is about localism, and we have an obligation to be looking at that.
Explain what Rupert Murdoch owns.
Well, I don't have a list with me. It would go on and on. He owns 35 full-power television stations, including a couple in New York. He owns Fox. They own distribution.
In New York, it would be the Wall Street Journal. It would be
New
York
Post.
WNYW,
WWOR.
And Fox.
There's a whole list of properties. If you look at the properties that all of these big companies own, it's mind-boggling. And it's not just traditional media. It's new media, too. And anybody who's interested in the future of that internet and all that ought to be interested in this issue, because it's the same trend toward consolidation. It's the same trend toward a few players moving in, taking over the news sites on the internet, and in some instances exercising control over that network. And it's a huge, huge deal for anybody who believes in internet freedom.
More than half of Americans surveyed said it should be illegal for a company to own a newspaper and a television station in the same market. This according to the Media and Democracy Coalition. More than half. Michael Powell got tremendous pushback. He talked about that when he ultimately left, was completely shocked by what happened. So why is Kevin Martin doing this?
Well, what's so interesting about that poll is that it's the same for Democrats, Republicans, moderates, conservatives. Virtually by the same margins, they oppose newspaper broadcast cross-ownership by 2-1. 70% of the American people think that media consolidation has gone too far already. Again, virtually the same proportion from conservatives and liberals. Americans understand that we don't want big media to get bigger. They don't trust big media. They don't trust big government. It's in the American spirit, going back to the American Revolution, that we've never liked media to dominate the landscape. We want to hear a diversity of voices. And when either one of these chairmen go after this, they are really putting their fist right into a hornet's nest of American public opposition.
Well, I'm sorry Kevin Martin isn't here to explain why he is pushing for this, but what is the timetable and what kind of input will the public have? You had your hearing yesterday with the last possible notice that could be given.
I think the timetable right now is known only to the chairman and has not been really made public. Everybody knows that he would like to do this. It's been reported that he had a plan originally that would have a vote taken place by December 18th, when everybody's busy wrapping their Christmas presents and Congress has gone home. But I don't see how that's possible right now, because we still haven't had the last media ownership hearing. And we really have no business tackling this until we finish these other proceedings that have been pending at the commission for so long. We have had, for example, the localism proceeding pending since 2004. We have public interest obligations, especially in the DTV age. What should these DTV broadcasters be doing to serve the public? Why don't we finish those things? Why don't we figure out about diversity and what we're going to do to increase minority and female ownership? Then do it. We've got the cart before the horse.
What is your plan to increase minority and women ownership?
Well, I think it has to be a multifaceted attack. Jonathan and I and many of the folks who were there yesterday would be very much in favor of Congress legislating again some kind of a tax certificate program to increase incentives for minority owned. But there are things that we can be doing at the commission. If a woman or a minority group wants to buy a station, why can't we say, well, it takes a while to raise money in this environment. Why can't we give that group a little bit longer to go out and raise money or extend construction deadlines? We've had committees look at this. Our own diversity committee sent tons of recommendations upstairs for the chairman to see. They basically were stuck there for a year or 2 years and then only kind of grudgingly put out for comment a few weeks ago. But we don't want just comment back. We want action.
Jonathan Adelstein, what can the FCC do to protect public access, to require that AT&T and Verizon provide the same capacity, as cable companies that currently are responsible for making sure that public access continues?
Well, just yesterday, again, over the opposition of Mike Copps and myself, the commission voted 3-2 to further unravel support for public access programming by cable companies. Basically, we gave the new entrants, AT&T and Verizon, something of a pass, saying that you don't have to provide very much. We're going to force localities over their own objections to allow you to serve the community, whether or not you agree to what the local officials are requesting, which is all in violation of the way that Congress set it out in the law. And yesterday we said, well, since we gave such a giveaway to the new entrants, we've got to give the same benefit to the cable companies. So cable companies who already have perfectly well-working deals with local communities, now can get to the lowest common denominator. They can get the same sweetheart deal that the new entrants get, even when the deal's been worked out with local authorities. We're basically riding roughshod over local municipalities and states all across the United States. We're undercutting support for PEG, and which is public and educational governmental channels. These are the channels where you can watch your local city council, or you can watch your own locally produced programming. We have just kicked the legs out from under it. The only good news is I think it was in violation of the law, and eventually the courts will catch on, and that will get overturned. But in the meantime, a lot of damage will be done.
You've used the term media sharecropping. What do you mean?
Well, there's been a lot of talk about leasing or allowing some people to just borrow the airwaves, minorities, for example. But minorities want to be owners. They deserve to be owners. African Americans, who represent a large portion and so many contributions to society, deserve to own media outlets in proportion to their population. Latinos, who are growing rapidly, virtually unrepresented in terms of who owns the outlets. Ownership is control, and leased access just doesn't cut it.
Michael Copps, are you going to hold hearings around the country the way both of you did when the son of Colin Powell was in charge, when Michael Powell was in charge?
Well, we have been attending hearings around the country. We got the chairman to commit only to 6 hearings this time. We asked for like a dozen, but there are lots of groups, lots of members of Congress, consumer groups, and advocacy groups that have been holding hearings, and Jonathan and I have attended a lot of those and are willing to attend.
And how do people weigh in right now as Kevin Martin is pushing through the relaxation of media ownership rules?
Well, what they should be doing is letting the FCC know exactly how they feel. We have a couple of new commissioners who weren't there last time. Everybody should know how the public feels, members of Congress. It's a grassroots effort. It really is. And people should take heart. Last time, we had 3 million people go on record in opposition to what Chairman Powell was trying to do. I didn't know there were 3 million people who even knew there was a place called the FCC when I went there in 2001. They found out, and they found out you told them, but big media didn't tell them. Consumer groups, advocacy groups told them. Jonathan and I tried to do our little part in getting that message out. But they understand when you go around and say, these are your airwaves, and you have this little agency on the shores of the Anacostia that's mucking around with them and going to change how they're used substantially, and they're doing it in secret, or they get mad. They get very proprietary about it. They understand it. It's not arcane. It's not esoteric. It's public interest.
I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Michael Copps, Jonathan Adelstein, the two FCC dissident commissioners. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll look at the growing opposition to the Attorney General nominee, Michael Mukasey. Stay with us.
Thank you. One day we'll come in.
Duty column stretch for dawn here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Opposition to Attorney General nominee Michael Mukasey is growing after the retired federal judge refused again to declare the practice of waterboarding a form of torture. On Wednesday, Senate Majority Whip Dick Durbin of Illinois and Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island announced they'll join Democratic Senator Joe Biden of Delaware in voting against Mukasey's nomination. All three serve on the Senate Judiciary Committee, which will vote on Mukasey's nomination on Tuesday. A party-line vote by the Democrats on the Judiciary Committee could block Mukasey's nomination from reaching the Senate floor, but the remaining Democrats on the committee have declined to say how they'll vote. The controversy over Mukasey centers on his comments about the interrogation practice known as waterboarding, which is widely considered a form of torture. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island asked Mukasey about waterboarding during the second day of his confirmation hearings on October 18th.
Finish that thought. So is waterboarding constitutional?
I don't know what's involved in the technique. If waterboarding is torture, torture is not constitutional.
If waterboarding is constitutional is a massive hedge.
No, I said if it's torture. I'm sorry, I said if it's torture.
If it's torture, that's a massive hedge. I mean, it either is or it isn't. Do you have an opinion on whether waterboarding, which is the practice of putting somebody in a reclining position, strapping them down, putting cloth over their faces, and pouring water over the cloth to simulate the feeling of drowning, is that constitutional?
If it amounts to torture, it is not constitutional.
I'm very disappointed in that answer. I think it is purely semantic.
That was Attorney General nominee Michael Mukasey questioned by Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island on October 18th. Earlier this week, Mukasey issued an additional written response about his views on waterboarding. He wrote he feels the practice seems over the line and repugnant, but he said he does not have enough information to determine if it's illegal. The New York Times reports Mukasey might be refusing to say waterboarding is illegal because it could open the door to criminal or civil liability for many CIA and military interrogators. Some legal experts suggest liability could go all the way to President Bush if he explicitly authorized waterboarding. On the campaign front, Senators Christopher Dodd, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama have all announced they'll also vote against Mukasey when his nomination goes before the full Senate. Three Republicans on the Judiciary Committee, Lindsey Graham, John McCain, and John Warner, have criticized Mukasey's response, but they've suggested they'll support the nomination. To talk more about the nomination, Marjorie Cohn joins us. She's president of the National Lawyers Guild, a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, author of the new book, Cowboy Republic, Six Ways the Bush Gang has defied the law. She's in Washington this week for the National Lawyers Guild's 70th anniversary. Congratulations.
Thank you, Amy.
Mukasey, your assessment.
Mukasey has made it clear that he is going to construe the law in favor of presidential power. And when he says that he doesn't know what waterboarding is, he's probably the only person in this country, and indeed in many countries, who doesn't know what waterboarding is. And he can't say whether it's torture or not. And yet Rear Admiral John Hudson, who also testified at the hearing, said, other than perhaps the rack and thumb screws, waterboarding is the most iconic example of torture in history. It was devised, I believe, in the Spanish Inquisition. It has been repudiated for centuries.
That was
John Hudson, retired Navy admiral, who also testified at Mukasey's confirmation.
Why do you think Mukasey will not say it's torture?
Because the Bush administration has tried from the beginning to insulate itself against war crimes prosecutions. Under the U.S. War Crimes Act, torture can be prosecuted as a war crime. And even if the person didn't personally commit the torture, commanders all the way up the chain of command to the commander-in-chief can be held liable if they knew or should have known their subordinates would be torturing and they did nothing to stop or prevent it. And Bush knows that, and he is walking a very fine line. Mukasey's walking a very fine line, because if he says that waterboarding is torture, and the administration has admitted that it has engaged in waterboarding at least three times, then we're talking about war crimes liability, and it could go all the way up the chain of command. And I also want to say that one of the people who was waterboarded was colleague Sheikh Mohammed at one of the secret CIA black sites, and he was supposedly the mastermind of the 9/11 attacks, and he was waterboarded and tortured so severely that his information is practically worthless, which means that the waterboarding is actually interfering with the administration's ability to get good intelligence to stop terrorism.
Marjorie Cohen, you're testifying today in Congress.
Yes, at the House Judiciary Committee. It's a public policy forum. I'm going to be testifying about torture from 2 to 4 p.m. in the Rayburn office building. I think it's room 2141.
And why is the hearing being held?
The hearing is being held. It also covers the illegality of the war. And it's being held so that Congress can understand why this illegality is happening in Iraq, and also looking toward an impending war on Iran, which would be equally illegal.
Congressmember Conyers holding the hearing?
He will be holding the hearing, yes.
You are celebrating the 70th anniversary of the National Lawyers Guild. Can you talk about why it formed?
In 1937, 70 years ago, the American Bar Association would not admit people of color. So the National Lawyers Guild started as an alternative to the American Bar Association. And during the last 70 years, National Lawyers Guild, legal people, lawyers, law students, legal workers have been involved in the cutting-edge struggles to support the rights of people. And our preamble says it all. And we're dedicated to the proposition that human rights are more sacred than property interests.
You have written a great deal about the Bush administration. What do you think is President Bush's greatest offense at this point?
The war in Iraq is clearly his greatest offense, and the torture is part and parcel of that. And in his so-called war on terror, he has really made us less safe. He has put many of our lives in danger, and more than 3,800 people have lost their lives in this country. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqis have been killed. Untold numbers of people have been wounded on both sides. And in fact, he is rattling—he and Cheney are rattling the sabers against Iran and promised to do even more horrible damage.
Have the Democrats coming to power in Congress made a difference?
They are holding hearings. So far, that's the only difference. They gave him this so-called Protect America Act, which legalizes his illegal spying program, which is not used just to spy on the terrorists, but also used to spy on dissidents, people who dissent against the administration policy. And I've seen a lot of timidity on the part of the Democrats. This vote in the Senate Judiciary Committee that's going to happen next week on the Mukasey nomination is going to be very telling to see if the Democrats put their money where their mouth is. And it's not just waterboarding. If you look at his testimony, it supports the Bush administration in lockstep right down the line.
In what other ways?
He would not say that the president is forbidden from violating congressional statutes like the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that regulates electronic surveillance. He would not say that he would follow the law in referring congressional contempt citations to the grand jury the way the law requires when Congress holds people in contempt for refusing to testify about the Attorney General spying purge. He refused to say that the president cannot hold a U.S. citizen caught in the United States indefinitely. He refused to say that habeas corpus is constitutional under the suspension clause of the Constitution for all people. And it goes on and on and on.
Marjorie Cohen, I want to thank you for being with us. Marjorie Cohen, who is president of the National Lawyers Guild, celebrating 70 years. It was established in 1937. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharifa Dogadouz, Aaron Mate, Angelique Comet, Steve Hagerman, Ricardo Lobo, Steve Martinez, Kizzy Cox. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan and Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.